going to start the day off with information hearing on from the local governments, and we'll go ahead and start with the counties. So they want to come forward, introduce themselves.
Thank you, Chair Beyer. My name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And with me here today is Eric Schmidt, who's our informational manager for the Association of Oregon Counties. And if you'll bear with us, we're going to try and do a little PowerPoint presentation. However, I believe each one of you should have a copy of the slides at this point in front of you that we're going to go over. Also, before I start, I want to note that we have had the pleasure of meeting with each member of the Transportation Committee, with the exception of Representative Buckley at this point. And it's not that we haven't tried and he hasn't tried. It's just that we haven't been able to sync up the calendars at this point. So some of the information that you're going to hear today from us is some information that you've heard already. But I think to put things in perspective, I'm hoping that that we'll be able to provide some background and base for you to as you consider transportation and specifically the needs of Oregon's 36 counties. With that, kind of as some background, Madam Chair, Oregon's counties manage a portion of a seamless system of roads throughout the state of Oregon. And as you know, that the highway system or the road system is owned and managed by cities, counties, and the state of Oregon at this point. Most people don't know who owns the road that they're driving on, except maybe when you're on the interstate system. You drive up I-5, you know, by golly, that's managed by the state of Oregon. But when I get to Shoals Ferry Road, at least in Washington County, up until very recently, that was a state highway. Or 82nd in Portland is a state highway. Sandy Boulevard, and we can go around the state of Oregon, and I'm sure you know you can think of state highways that really function as a local road. And so the person who's driving and going to Grandma and Grandpa's over the weekend or going to the store really doesn't know whether they're on a city street or a county road. And while we have a seamless system, you go from one to the other without really knowing it. The management of the system is not as seamless because we have counties looking at their resources and trying to manage the system. We have the state doing that, and we also have the cities doing it. So the management of the system is not as seamless as one might think. Oregon's 36 counties are very diverse, and we just wanted to give you just briefly, you know, just because you are the most populous in the state, populous county in the state, doesn't mean you're the largest. And just because you're the largest county in the state doesn't mean you have the most miles. All of the counties are very different and diverse, and we would hope that this information just provides some perspective on the diversity that you find in Oregon's 36 counties. And it's interesting to note, as you see on the left-hand column here, that in Western Oregon, 87% of the population is there. But you don't have 87% of the geographic area of the state of Oregon there. County roads provide many different functions. You have roads that are related to urban development. You have a number of county bridges that are there are bridges that are very important. We have a lot of bridges, actually, and Representative Tomei talked about the Selwood Bridge the other day. In fact, most of the bridges that you have in downtown Portland, you'd think they would be managed by owned by the city of Portland. They're all county bridges. You have county bridges and you have state bridges going over the Willamette River at this point. Needless to say, there are a number of suburban roads and a lot of rural roads that provide basically the infrastructure for a lot of the agriculture and forestry and the ability to move product throughout the state and through the state. Highway 97 now is being considered as a parallel to I-5, and with the idea of improving that so that you can have major truck traffic along that corridor through the central portion of the state. When you look at the system of highways and roads, the state highways is approximately 8,000 miles. County roads, approximately 26,000. And that does not include local service roads that have not been taken into the county system for management at this point, and these are very rural roads, if you will. And city streets, approximately a little over 10,000 miles of city streets throughout the state for a system of approximately 44,000 miles of state highways, county roads, and city streets. The county system, if we look at, you know, what's paved, and the paved roads are primarily in western Oregon, with more unpaved roads in eastern Oregon, I guess we all have come to know and realize that. But of the 26,000 miles, there's approximately 16,000 miles throughout the system that is paved, and approximately 10,000 miles then that are unpaved. Next, we would provide you some information about the classification of arterials, collectors, and local roads, and you can see there that we have approximately 900 miles of arterials in the system, 11,400 miles that are classified as collectors, and 13,000 miles of local roads that provide service to properties primarily, and they provide for some through trips and connection of communities, but not as much as the collector system. The collector system, I think, you know, you can look at that as the backbone of the system that connects the communities that we have, the cities around the state of Oregon, with the state highway system at this point. And that's one of the primary functions of the county arterials and collectors. As I mentioned, the county system is somewhat diverse, and you can see that we have 3,400 bridges, and we were able with OTIA 3 to repair and replace some of those bridges, but there is a lot of bridges still in the queue that need attention in terms of maintenance, repair, and in some instances replacement. And then there's a lot of discussion about culverts. Culverts and Fisk Passage are very important, and you can see right now within the system of just county roads, there are some 26,000 culverts. So we have a system that provides a variety of functions, and it is quite broad in the elements that compose that system. If we look at current revenue that is available to the counties, this pie chart shows that approximately 36% of the revenue received by counties comes from the state highway funds. And you can see a modest amount from property taxes, state and federal grants, and other things like systems development charges that some counties have that provide some funding. But I call your attention to the USFS revenue. This is the federal forest revenue that has come to counties historically. Almost 100 years ago is when it started, as part of the federal government providing some money back to the local areas as an offset to the federal forest cuts and revenue that was taken from the federal forest lands because they don't pay property tax. They had this way of sharing revenue for primarily roads and schools. And initially, when this program was set up, 75% went to roads, 25% went to schools. I call your attention to that 25% because that's the 25% that basically has gone away with the fact that PL 106-393 was not reauthorized. So the revenue pie that you see here, there'll be a little teeny slice where that 25% is because there is still some cut. But that cut is a small segment of what there was, let's say, back in the 1980s up to 1990 when we had the owl situation, and the cut from federal forest lands was curtailed significantly at this point. And I'll maybe talk about that a little bit more, but the revenue that is available to counties has shrunk at this point as a result of that, and the last payments are being received by counties at this time, and as they do their budget, they're having to budget without the $90 plus million that counties have received at this point. In terms of the state highway fund, I thought you might be interested in how that is shared. We always look to the state highway fund as a significant contribution to cities, counties, and the state in terms of the revenue for the the surface transportation system. And currently, and this is based on 2006 information, as you can see, ODOT gets 62%, counties get 22%, and cities get about 15.5% of the money that is distributed from the state highway fund. Next, you might ask yourself, well, where does the counties at least spend their portion of that money that's available to them? And the next pie chart that we have for you to view is shows expenditures in a gross general way at this point. And I would offer to you that counties have been and continue to be good custodians of the system that they have. They spend approximately 63% of the dollars that they have available to them on maintenance and preservation. And then, as you can see, approximately 37% is spent on congestion or capital projects at this point. And so that's how we spend the money. This last year, we spent quite some time working with the 36 counties to identify needs, and all of you except Representative Buckley, which I have a copy for, and as soon as we can meet, and I'll give you this today, Representative Buckley have received a report on county road needs, and there is a considerable amount of information in that report based on the state, on the 36 counties as a whole, looking at the needs that they've identified based on some parameters that we established. And there is specific information with regard to projects that we have available, so if you're interested in specifics and more specifics with regard to a particular county, we can provide that in the future. But I do urge you to review this document, take a look at it, and if we can help you by answering any questions, please let us know. Based on the criteria of looking at projects that you could build in the next 5 years or things that you could undertake and accomplish within a five-year period, they identified $433 million worth of additional need, if you will, in the 36 counties. And that is broken down into needs for, excuse me.
We have a question.
Yes.
So this 433 is over a five-year period.
That
a little
is
less
in
than $100 million a year, then.
Chair Beyer, Representative Gilman, that is an annual for the 5 years.
Oh, that's the annual.
Yeah,
okay.
That's the annual need.
Okay.
Each year for 5 years, they would need that amount of money.
Thank you.
Excuse me.
I'm sorry if I didn't clarify that appropriately. Thank you for the question. And that does not include the additional $90 million that I mentioned with 106,393. So the gap has, if you will, has grown to 523. And this is based on projects that you've identified. And we know that's a really big number. And you're probably not going to be able to, even if, you know, if we had a million or 100 million, 200 million, you're not, you know, you're going to do some of those, but not all of them at this point. And as I indicated earlier, there's been a lot of difficult decisions as to where we've spent that money. The needs that I indicated 319 in terms of congestion, 69 in terms of preservation projects, and 44 million a year in terms of maintenance. And you might say, okay, well, why is the maintenance and preservation numbers fairly low compared to congestion? Well, it's because that's where we've been taking 63% of the dollar and putting, so that we didn't have the big problem, astronomical problem with maintenance and preservation at this point. So I think it helps demonstrate that the counties have been good custodians of the resources they have in trying to maintain the system. But we do have problems with congestion. We have problems with natural disasters. And as you can see here, here you've got a slide with a school bus and trying to take kids to school. And so the system that we maintain, for the general public has a lot of different functions. And it's important to not only the commerce and freight, but it's also important to get people back and forth to work, for tourism, for for the educational system, so they can get their buses to and from the system. Preservation, again, is extremely important. And you can see here's a road that probably wasn't maintained. It hasn't been, it's on the cusp of probably having to be totally rebuilt rather than, preserved for the future, so it had another 10 or 15 years of life at this point. I'm going to skip over a little bit of 106-393 at this point, because I've talked about that, so let me just skip over. But let me
Madam Chair, let me ask a question. Art, before you skip over that, I'm fairly new to the Transportation Committee, so some of this, I've heard it, but I don't really fully understand this. So how long have we known that we were going to be losing this federal money?
PL 106-393 was established in year 2000 in response to the curtailment with a cut of federal forests. And so it was established in the year 2000, first when it was authorized. It was reauthorized for a six-year period, so that would have been 96, no, after that. So because the six-year period has just run out, and well, it was 2006, okay? So it ran out. So we've known potentially, I guess, if you will, for a while. And there's been discussion in Washington, D.C. for the last 2 years about reauthorizing. The efforts have been going on. And if you look on the plus side, you'd say, well, there was the significant number of states that get some benefit here with this program. And there was a lot of representatives, congressional delegations that were working on this. Certainly Oregon was. But the problem has always been an offset. With hurricanes and wars, trying to come up with the $500 million that this program is countrywide, it's been a difficult chore to do. One of the problems that we have, and you may have heard this, is that it's, let's say, $500 million for the program for all the states that have benefit of having federal lands. Oregon gets half. So, or approximately $250 million a year. So it's been a big effort at this point, and you could say, yeah, we've known it's been coming. And people have been trying to do stuff. There's a few years ago, eight counties put gas tax on the ballot. They all went down in flames. Some counties in the interim have put county road districts on and have been doing different things. But I only want to say that this not only affects roads, but this affects schools,
Yes. And
this affects county general funds. So when you look at it, when you look at the system between of state and county shared services, dealing with public health areas, dealing with public safety issues. You know, it will come to bear there also at this point. And so it's farther reaching than just roads at this point, which we kind of focus on here. Does that help?
That does. Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
And let me, something that may help you a little bit more. You should have this one page handout at this point talking about the impacts to Oregon counties. And you'll see the impact on county general fund and also the impact on the county road funds at this point by county, and what the impact is. And so maybe that'll help put things in perspective.
Yeah, okay.
And I'm sure that you'll kind of focus on the counties that are within your district at this point. And I think it's important to know. I'm sure you probably, some of you have been contacted by your county commissioners and judges in some instances with regard to, you know, the impact that they're going through at this point as they start their budgeting process.
Thank you, Art.
Getting back then, Madam Chair, to just the impact, this bar chart, you know, helps demonstrate, as you can see in the red, that the county's received about $100 million a year for roads. And in the green is the cut. So what we're going to do is we're going to go down to the cut in terms of what revenue the counties receive for you know, based on the actual resource extraction in our federal forests at this point, the logging that takes place and the resources that are extracted at this point. So there will be a trickle of money, but as you can see, the reduction is monumental. Counties, as I indicated, are going through their budget process. They're going to be looking at layoffs. They're going to be looking at the reduction of services as well as projects, which is going to have an impact on private contractors within their community that have been doing a lot of that work. It's also going to have an impact on the partnership between cities and the counties and the state and the county as they look to sharing revenue for projects, for transportation projects, and a lot of that's been going on over the last 10 years at this point. So then there's going to be the impact as we look at the system probably beginning to, I won't say fail, but have less attention paid to it, that there's going to be impact on the business community and the ability to of businesses to get their products to market and to critical points at this point. I think in terms of concluding, Chair Beyer and members of the committee, the key points here are that the state and counties and the cities provide a seamless road system. The county's road system is in critical need of additional revenue, and I will only say that I believe that the state and the cities are in the same situation. We might be a little bit more strapped at this point due to the hemorrhage of 106-393, and that there is a need to continue to work together on a multi-session strategy to address the needs of for transportation. And we encourage the committee to look at a transportation package this session to increase revenue for roads across the spectrum for all three of the managers of the system. Finally, Madam Chair, would just mention that AOC has I guess I'll say endorsed or looking at an increase in the gas tax, an increase in registration, a first-time title, potentially, fee, and also the look at the indexing as different, I guess, pots or different areas that you could look at to increase revenue for transportation this session. So with that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative
Buckley. Thank you, Madam Chair. Art, I'm wondering if the Association of Oregon Counties is working in any way with the governor's office and with other people involved with still trying to push in Washington, D.C. on a peer-to-peer basis. Some of the members of the legislature are contacting members of legislatures in New Mexico and Nevada to make the case. Is AOC doing anything with your colleagues in counties in states whose delegations could prove to be vital to securing funds?
Chair Beyer, Representative Buckley, yes, we are. We're intimately involved with other counties, with the National Association of Counties, with the ONC counties and the ONC consortium to look at everything that can be done to bring additional focus and reauthorization of this program, be it for 1 year or more. But if, as we talked to, in fact, some of our executive director was in Washington, D.C. all last week with other, with the president of our organization, Bobby Green from Lane County. And I would just say that they did not return with much optimism. And so the prudent, you know, the prudent thing as counties begin to do their budget is they're either going to do two budgets or they're going to have to do a budget based on the resources that they have. And yes, the answer to your question, yes, we're doing everything possible and working with the governor's office. And it's my understanding that he may be soon issuing an executive order to at least to try and help. But again, we're looking, you know, to at least to help have state agencies look to see how they might be able to help counties. But that's just one small piece at this point.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I have a question. Based on your comments earlier about a number of counties going out for gas taxes and not being successful, if a gas tax were to come forward this session that had a preemption on it, would you still oppose it?
Madam Chair, you want me to go out on the limb? Madam Chair, we are supportive of a gas tax. And I'm not going to say, I can't say exactly because we haven't talked about it. But I think we would seriously consider a preemption because counties have to refer. We're required to refer any gas tax increase that a county considers to the electorate. I think we would seriously consider a preemption, especially if that gas tax increase had indexing as part of that proposal. Because if we do gas tax and then don't come back for a while without indexing, we'll then start falling back again. And if indexing was part of that, then I think that would allay some of that fear. I think that would merit very serious consideration.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity.
If you'd like any more information about PL 106393, we have lots of charts and lots of information for you. Just give us a call.
Actually, I've heard too much about it.
We don't think there's too much to know.
Thank you. Next, we're going to hear from the cities, and we have Andy Shaw with us today. And some others. Welcome, and come up and introduce yourselves.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and committee members. My name is Andy Shaw with the League of Cities. Thank you for inviting us today to come talk about local transportation needs. I have with me Mark Bechtel of the City of Salem and Shirley Kalkoven of the Mayor of New Salem, who will speak after me. Our primary goal today is to express deep concern about the lack of adequate funding for road maintenance and preservation. If we go back to the early 1990s, Oregon cities were doing pretty well in terms of road funding. City's core funding sources, the property tax, was a stable and growing revenue source. State gas taxes were being increased regularly, and federal funding was generally keeping pace. However, with the enactment of Measures 5 and 50 in the 1990s, capping cities' property tax revenues, with the last gas tax increase occurring in 1993, and road resources, especially those available for maintenance and preservation, began diminishing. Measures 5 and 50 forced cities to focus in on core city services such as public safety and to shift other costs to the local street fund and other funds. At the same time, transportation and construction costs have skyrocketed, particularly in the past few years, with a 10% inflationary increase just in 2006. So not only have new resources for maintenance and preservation dropped off, but the purchasing power of our existing funding is falling at an accelerating pace. We participated, along with ODOT and the counties, this summer in a critical needs survey. Some of the results have been discussed already. Our estimate of the city gap between what we spend now and what we should be spending to properly maintain city roads and avoid expensive reconstruction is about $160 million annually. And that's a permanent cost, ongoing, just to maintain what the investment we have. Cities are making enormous efforts to identify and raise adequate revenues to pay for road maintenance, modernization, and capacity expansion, including using local transportation utility fees, enacting local gas taxes, and raising impact charges on new developments to pay for new roads that are constructed with those developments. But the local governments cannot fill the need gap by themselves. We believe it's in everyone's interest to have a strong local road infrastructure. Strong economic growth depends on sturdy and sustainable local infrastructure, and cities know that we need to be preparing to accommodate a million people or so in the next 20 years. We believe a vast majority of those people will be moving into our cities. So preserving our roads is not only critical to attracting economic development and the movement of people and goods and to accommodating growth, it's also an important safety issue. Rutted and cracked roads increase the number of accidents, placing our residents at greater risk, causing damage to other public and private assets, and increasing congestion. Between the state and local governments, we've invested billions of dollars in our transportation infrastructure, and we need to protect that investment by spending the money that's required to maintain and preserve our roads properly. To talk about how cities maintain and manage the assets that we do have, I'll turn it over now to Mark Bechtel from the City of Salem.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the House Transportation Committee. My name is Mark Bechtel. I'm the Transportation Services Manager for the City of Salem Public Works Department. It's indeed a privilege to be before you today to talk about how cities in Oregon manage their pavements and their street operations and maintenance activities, and the challenges that we're facing as we go into the future years of our funding and our pavement lifespans. Very briefly, I'd just like to cover for you some things about how we rate pavements and inspect them, how we manage our pavements, what kinds of maintenance treatments that we apply towards those pavements, and then some of the challenges that we're facing. Much the same as ODOT or the counties, the cities manage their street pavements as a physical asset, and we use pavement management systems to do that. And I would direct you to the handout that I was handed out to the committee to talk about how we embark on managing those pavements. One of the first things that we do is we, on a very periodic basis, go out and inspect our pavements, or we hire firms to do so. And those pavements are inspected for 13 different distress factors. And from those distress factors, we come up with what's called a pavement condition index, or a great acronym, PQI. Every street in the city of Salem, for example, is inspected once every 3 years for its pavement condition. When we look at that pavement condition index, it's rated on a score of 0 to 100. 0 being a failed pavement and 100 being a perfect brand new pavement in excellent quality. We then look at our pavements and try to match up to them based on their condition what type of maintenance treatment would best serve that segment of street. And of course we're going to look for those maintenance types that use the least amount of resources but get the most cost effective return for us. There's four types of maintenance treatments that we concentrate on. One is preventative maintenance, And you'll see that in your local communities where they go out and they'll do slurry seals or thin overlays to protect and renew the surface of the street, seal it up from water intrusion. The next step is corrective maintenance. This is pothole patching, digging out bad areas and patching. These types of activities do not extend the life of the pavement, but they do hold it together. Pavement rehabilitation is getting into a little more involved activities and certainly more costly. Pavement rehabilitation means that we're going to mill off several inches of pavement and put it back with new pavement, or we're going to just overlay it with several inches of structural pavement. The most expensive type of treatment that we do is reconstruction. Reconstruction literally means going back out and rebuilding the street from beginning to end, starting with the base and going to a new pavement structure. The cost for doing these different treatments can vary, and I would direct you to the next to the last slide in your handout. If you look at what we call the asphalt pavement life cycle, pavement condition as compared to time and traffic on that street, over time and with a lot of traffic, every pavement will decrease in its condition if left unmaintained. But every treatment that we can do to those pavements have different costs and different cost-benefit results. If we can apply preventative maintenance at $2 to $18 per square yard and do that several times, we can extend the life of that pavement for a relatively cheap cost almost indefinitely. However, if we start getting down into the more expensive treatments for pavement, you can see how much additional effort it takes to bring that pavement back up to its original condition and how much more money is involved. An example I would give you is if you take 1,000 square yards of street pavement and you apply a slurry seal, it's going to cost you $4,000. If you have to go out and do some corrective measures for a thin overlay, it goes up to $15,000. If you have to rehabilitate that pavement, you're now talking $60,000. And if you have to rebuild that street, you're talking $100,000. So we like to use the phrase that our colleagues at ODOT have coined, and that is, you can pave me now, or you can pay more later. And so every city that I'm aware of wants to maintain its pavements at that upper end of that life cycle, where it's more cost-effective to use preventative maintenance. What is happening to the cities in Oregon is, because of the tight resources that we have and the incredible increases in inflationary cost increases we've had in pavement and materials, we're watching our pavements slide down that slope into where we're going to have to now put more money into reconstruction and rehabilitation. I think all of you that drive on Salem streets are aware of the condition of them as you come in for the session. And speaking for the city of Salem, we are watching our streets slowly slide down that slope to where we're going to have to spend more money to maintain them. Just to give you an idea, our allocation of state highway funds went up 1.4% in fiscal year 05-06. In our current fiscal year, we actually have a decrease in our allocation of 3.2%. Our forecasts show that our allocation of state highway funds for the city of Salem will only go up 1 to 2% for each of the next 2 years. Compare that to a 37% increase in the price of hot mix asphalt just last summer alone. Compare that to a 22% increase in the cost of electricity for our streetlights and traffic signals. There are many other materials and services that we use that have experienced significant inflationary cost increases. When we compare revenues to our costs, that is one reason why we're watching our streets slide down in quality, because we do not have the resources to maintain them in that cost-effective zone, so to speak. In closing, just as representing cities and in general with the League of Oregon Cities, any actions that could be taken by the legislature that would allow these allocations of state highway funds to better compete or better offset the impacts of inflation for cities would be very much appreciated. Chair Byer, I thank you for your time and members of the committee, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay.
Good afternoon. I'm Shirley Kalkoven, the mayor of Nehalem, Representative Byer and members of the committee. I wear a few other hats. longtime member of the League of Cities Transportation Commission, when we had an ODOT Local Officials Advisory Committee. I used to attend those meetings as a city representative. Spent a lifetime in the construction industry, building streets, highways, roads, and sewers, so I understand some of the problems about building them, the costs, and maintaining them. I also chair the Northwest Area Commission on Transportation, but I wanted to talk to you for a few minutes today about what transportation costs are like for a really small city like mine. Nehalem has an official population of 210 people, and Highway 101 runs right through our downtown. In fact, this last year, we have been having a ODOT maintenance project repaving 5 miles of Highway 101 that's going through Nehalem and our neighboring city of Wheeler. That's been an interesting experience, and we're going to be delighted when it's done, but it's been difficult to live through it. But, you know, for a small city like mine, we sort of live on what we can get out of the gas tax. And last year, we got $10,175. And it's been a couple of years since we've been able to get a small city street allotment of $25,000. When we're fortunate enough to get one of those small city allotments, that $25,000 today will pave about 2.5 blocks of one of our small city streets. So you can see that $10,000 in gas tax money doesn't go very far. But we really don't have any resources to raise any other kinds of funds. And that's why small cities like mine and others in Oregon look to the state to look for additional sources of revenue to help us with this ever-increasingly serious problem of maintenance of what we've got. I was told yesterday at a meeting that my county, Tillamook County, has the worst roads in Oregon. Our pavement index, a measure, is down to 51 and dropping rapidly. Tillamook County will lose 40% of the funding for its road department in this next budget. That's almost $2 million, and our general fund will take a pretty good-sized hit, which is of concern to me because I'm one of the three citizen members of the budget committee. I understand that the city of Springfield is in almost the same kind of financial straits, losing huge percentages of the dollars that they use to fund their road departments. You know, it was great when we had OTIA 1 and OTIA 2. Local communities put up a lot of match in OTIA 1 to the extent that those original bond funds went far enough that we were able to have OTIA 2 for another $100 million in projects. And when we used to have the local official advisory committee meetings with ODOT, when it got to OTIA 3 and the Transportation Commission was talking about a local match of 25% for a project, Art was there. He will remember the conversation that Bruce Warner later described as robust, because believe me, it was very robust. We were trying to make the case that, you know, the local cash registers got emptied on OTIA 1 and 2. We don't have any more money. It's all we can do to hold things together the way it is. So we are looking to you for leadership and hopefully some funding increases that are going to help us out of our dilemma. And with that, let me stop, and I'll be happy to answer any questions. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. Well, I have the one question, probably not fair. I come from a city that actually has a gas tax, so but if it came with a preemption, would you fight it, or...
The needs we've identified are very large just to maintain and preserve the road assets that we have now. I know the cost of congestion study that's coming out of the Portland metro area is looking at spending billions more to expand capacity and reduce congestion, but also prepare for growth. Given all those needs, the gas tax would probably have to be pretty high before cities would feel comfortable having their ability to raise local gas tax preempted. But we don't have position on that exact question today.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for coming today. Appreciate it. Okay, committee. I'm going to close the informational meeting now, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2034. And today I'm going to let committee staff do her job, and I'm not going to try to do it for her like I did the other day. So, Judith, would you like to explain the bill?
Good job, Madam Chair.
You did great. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2034, it's pretty loud to me, expands the exemption from Oregon car title, car registration, driver's license, and driver permit requirements to include those that have been a resident of Oregon for less than 30 days. It also changes a reference regarding driving privileges for non-residents from driving privileges granted by, quote, a home jurisdiction of the person to a reference of an out-of-state license or a driver's permit. We have received a no fiscal impact on the measure. I have provided you as well relevant residency statutes for your easy reference. That's directly behind your staff measure summary. And we do have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judith. Well, we have one person signed up to testify, and I'm going to call him, but first I would like to call Art Schlack up to give us a little background on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Art Schlack with the Association of Oregon Counties. Some of you may remember this bill from the 2005 session, and it is exactly the same as House Bill 2731, which was passed by the Transportation Committee, recommended passage of the bill. It passed the House, went over to the Senate, and the Senate found wisdom in adding something to the bill which created some problems. So at the end of the day, there was a conference committee that was appointed, we were all fortunate to leave the building before the conference committee could do any work. So that's a lot to say that this bill was considered in 2007. It's exactly the same that you, the House Transportation Committee, looked at and sought support for that. Just very briefly, what this bill does is that there is no time frame in the statute currently for a person who qualifies as a resident of the state to for them to get their driver's license, title their car, or register their car in the state of Oregon. The state of Washington to the north has a similar requirement, and it has a 30-day time frame in it. The state of California to the south has a requirement, and it has a 15-day time frame to accomplish the three things that I've mentioned. We chose 30 days, thinking that's reasonable. It's very surprising and interesting, as I've talked to even members of the committee and others, that people have thought that there was a time frame. But in actuality, there has not, and it is it's not infrequent that people will move to the state from Indiana or wherever, and they've got a year and a half still on their plates, or other requirements, and they say, well, when they run out, I'll go do what I need to do. I'll go up, get plates in the state of Oregon. This at least would put a time frame for those people that are coming here so that they know, they don't have an indefinite period of time. There is a time, and it can be enforced. It's very difficult to enforce something that doesn't have at least some reference. And I think it's would be beneficial for those people that that are living in and residing and working in the state of Oregon and meeting the requirements at this point to have you know, their to title their car and get their driver's license and those other things in an appropriate time frame. So this in some way I view as kind of housekeeping. And with that, Madam Chair, unless there's questions, I would urge the committee's support for House Bill 2034.
Thank you. Any questions come up in anybody's minds? Any concerns? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The next person is Jack Evans.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'm Jack Evans with the Department of Transportation, and I was asked to say a couple of words about the impact of this measure on ODOT, and I'll do just that. There is no impact that we can see, and we're not impacted. The enforcement of these measures fall to law enforcement, and so there'll be perhaps a change in behavior, but beyond that, there's nothing that will impact our agency.
Thank you. Representative Buckley?
I just want to thank Jack for his Zen-like non-testimony.
Any other questions?
I just have a question, Madam
yes.
Chair, to you. If this has no fiscal, why is this going to Ways and Means? Is that, we're not going to deal with that now? It's under work session, probably, huh?
All right. I'm going to close. If I'm not seeing any other testimony out there, I'm going to close the public hearing and go into work session. So if anyone has a motion.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2034 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means with a two-pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2034 with a due pass recommendation to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? All of those of the opinion that House Bill 2034 should be reported to the should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. We'll vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Buckley?
Aye.
Representative Gilman?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Chair Beyer?
Aye. The motion having received the required majority, it is declared passed. Thank you. I'll go back to my agenda. The next bill, do I go with another one?
You need to close the work session.
Close the work session on House Bill 2034, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2267. And Judith.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House Bill 2267 allows for the renewal of instruction driver's permits. It directs the Department of Transportation to issue a renewal if the holder qualifies for a permit, and the permit holder applies within 1 year of the expiration date or within 6 months after discharge from the armed services. It also allows the department to waive the driver's permit examination for permit renewal applicant. And it requires an invalid permit to be surrendered to the department. The renewal fee rate is set at $18, which is the current fee for the issuance of the driver's permit. And I just wanted to note, you may notice that the language seems to be repeated twice for both the renewal language and the fee language, and that is because it's referenced twice in statute, once for typical driver's permits, and then there is a separate program for those drivers with limited vision that has some restrictions on their driving at night and that sort of thing. So that's why you see it the language repeated twice. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. The first person we have signed up is Jack Evans. I'm going to mix it. I have two people signed up, and I just mixed their names together. So Jack Evans with ODOT. Thank you.
Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I wanted to speak in favor of our bill, House Bill 2267, addressing the renewal of instruction permits. And this is pretty much a customer service measure. I'll give you some background. This measure addresses instruction permits, which individuals get to learn how to operate a motorcycle, an automobile, or a commercial motor vehicle. There's about 110,000 of these right now that are valid. Each year, about 4,000 individuals apply to renew these permits. However, in statute, they are not allowed to renew the permit until it actually expires. So you have a situation where an individual perhaps hasn't taken the test yet, hasn't gotten the number of instruction, the number of supervised hours practice driving. They come in to get a renewal, and it's prior to their expiration date, they're turned away. So as you can imagine, it doesn't lead to a very happy customer service situation. And we want to clarify the statute to match the kinds of things we're doing with regular driver's licenses, which would be allow the individual to renew them before they expire, just as a customer service issue. And that's essentially what this measure will do.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you. Our next witness is Sandra Bishop.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Sandra Bishop. I'm here as the government relations representative for the DSAO, the Driving School Association of Oregon. The Driving School Association of Oregon is a nonprofit association representing the commercial driving schools. Members range from very small, single-operator family businesses to some of the largest professional driving schools in the state. Within the past year, it's estimated that more than half of the 20 or more certified commercial driving schools in Oregon have provided driver's education for teenagers in Oregon. And that's why we're here today, to support House Bill 2267. We support efforts by DMV to make it easier to renew driver's permits. Teenagers often get caught in the same scenario that the gentleman was just talking about. They've started their training, and then their permit runs out, and then there's a lot of disconnect in when they actually complete their training and their driver experience. So as an association, we represent the professionals that are teaching those new and inexperienced drivers, and we appreciate and support the need to have as much continuity as possible in obtaining the driver instructor permits, completing driver training, and acquiring the actual experience, driving experience necessary to qualify for an Oregon driver's license. In Oregon, about 10,000 teens under the age of 18 take driver education each year. Approximately 20% of those teens obtain that driver education from commercial driving schools. There are more than 44,000 teens in Oregon eligible to take driver education training each year. As you can see, there's a great disparity in the number of teens that take driver's ed and the number that are actually eligible to take it and probably need it. If you've driven on I-5 recently, you realize there's a lot of people out there that probably need driver's ed, not just the teens. Some of the teen drivers are actually the safer drivers because it's current in their mind and in their experience what they're doing. So there are a lot of barriers, and it's becoming more difficult for teens to get driver's ed, to obtain that training in Oregon. So we really appreciate the effort to make the renewal easier for the permits. So thank you.
Thank you. Any other testimony? All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2267, and I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2267. Colleagues, is...
It's a great bill.
Do I have a motion?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move passage of House Bill 2267 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Buckley moves House Bill 2267 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Boy, I have a quiet committee. I'm hoping that changes. Okay, those of the opinion that House Bill 2267 should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation will vote aye, and those opposed, no. And clerk will call the roll.
Representative Buckley?
Aye.
Representative Gilman?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Chair Beyer?
Aye. Okay, House Bill 2267, having received the a required majority, is declared passed.
Madam Chair, may I suggest that we put this on the consent calendar?
No objection.
I have no objection to that, so we'll add this bill. And I don't know for all of you who have been through the training, if you're aware that as long as there is no opposition, that's where it can go. Although we could, you know, hope it got to the floor first and we could give it to our freshmen, right? All right, I closed the work session on 2267. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2269.
Yeah, sure, we can do that right now. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House Bill 2269 increases fees for issuance of motor vehicle registration plates. The allocation of the revenues under current law, I have included the statutory reference for you there for your easy referral. We have not received the fiscal or revenue yet on this measure. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right. The first person up today is Jack Evans, our favorite person today.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'm Jack Evans with the Department of Transportation, and I'd like to speak in favor of House Bill 2269, which is our bill that would ensure that sufficient license plate fees are collected to recover rising manufacturing costs, and to secondly, to ensure that cities and counties continue to receive the same amount of revenue from these plates. Over the course of the last several years, we've seen rising costs, particularly in the metals industry and aluminum, and these have had an impact on the cost of license plates. In addition, the sheeting, which is the colored part that goes over the license plate, that's a petroleum product, so as you can imagine, that too has gone up. Certainly not as much as the aluminum has, but it is a factor. In statute, we have a statutory maximum of $5 fee that we can charge for a pair of plates or three for a single plate. So what the department does is it retains $2 for single plates and $3 for each pair to cover their manufacturing costs. The remaining $2 on a pair of plates then is distributed to cities and counties for their road-related expenses, and these are shared 40-60% among cities and counties. We anticipate that over the course of the next year we'll see rising aluminum costs. It's pretty much impossible to predict exactly what they are, but what we would like to do would be have the ability in rule to raise license plate fees to cover these manufacturing costs, and then to, in statute, dedicate the $1 and $2 to the cities and counties so that they'll still continue to maintain this source of funding for their road-related activities, and that'll stabilize that funding source. So with that, I'd like to ask for your support, and I'll answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions? All right.
Yes. Jack, there is no maximum, though, then. Currently, there's a maximum that you can charge. This legislation would remove that, and if aluminum went up three times, then that would be the amount that the plate would go up. Is that correct?
Chair Beyer, Representative Gilman, it does. The mechanism that would be used would be, and this is truly one that just captures the cost of manufacturing the plate. We get the weighted average cost from the vendor. We then round that up to the next half dollar, and that and then add the $2 for the cities and counties, and then that would generate the fee. So, for example, the weighted cost right now is about $2.91 for a pair of plates. You round that up to $3, and you add the $2 for the cities and counties, you have a fee of $5. Should the manufacturing costs go up to, say, $3.05, we would round that up to $3.50, pay the cities and counties their $2 share, and that would raise rates to the plate consumers by 50 cents. We anticipate that over the course of this year, we won't have a need to do that. In 2008, if we see maybe a 4 or 5% increase, then we're looking at probably having to raise the fee by about 50 cents on a pair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jack, could you say something briefly about your relationship with the vendor and history? Is it a single vendor, that sort of thing, please?
Yeah, Representative Beyer, or Chair Beyer, Representative Reed, yes, this is Erwin Hodson is the vendor. And I can't reconstruct exactly for you the history, but we're in the second year of a contract with them, and I believe this is our second contract. It's a five-year contract. They are we go out for competitive bids. They're a competitive firm. They've done a good job for us. We have a situation where this five-year contract, each year there's a cost adjustment clause, which allows that firm to come back and tell us what their increased costs are. ODOT, in turn, has the right to reject or accept those costs. Should we reject those costs, Erwin Hodson then will determine whether or not they want to go ahead with a contract. If they don't, we'll take it back out to bid. So that's the relationship. We're in the second year now. We've had about maybe a 4% increase this year, which is reasonable given the rising costs of the products. So,
thank you.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you say where the vendor's located? It's an Oregon company?
It's in Portland. Chaired by Representative Buckley, that organization is in Portland.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, no more questions. Thank you. Andy Shaw.
Good afternoon, Andy Shaw with the League of Cities. We're just here to lend our support to this measure. Cities and counties do receive a very small amount of revenue in comparison to the needs we spoke about earlier, but we would enjoy your support in protecting this one small source of revenue, and urge you to vote aye on House Bill 2269. Thank you.
Thank you. Art Schlack.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, Art Schlack with the Association of Oregon Counties. Good bill should pass.
Thank you. I'm going to, I guess I'll just announce it. We're not going to move this one today to a work session. I want to wait until all our members are here and make sure there aren't any concerns there. I don't have any concerns with it, but I do want to make sure everybody is on the same page. So I'm going to close the public hearing today, and we'll wait till another day to go to the work session. Thank you. And then last but not least, we have House Bill 2271, and I'm going to open a public hearing on 2271.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House Bill 2271 modifies the definition of registration weight to include loaded weight. This does have an emergency clause on the measure. Just for clarification, ORS 803.430 establishes procedures for determining the registration rate of vehicles. The procedures refer to a combined weight, so you'll see throughout the bill that you, after combined weight, they add loaded weight as an alternate criteria for weight measurements.
Thank you.
We have not received fiscal or revenue on this measure yet. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Jack Evans.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Jack Evans with the Department of Transportation, and I'd like to speak in support of House Bill 2271, which is our measure that will correct a problem with the statute and clarify the difference between combined weight and loaded weight for purposes of vehicle registration. We want to ensure that larger, heavier vehicles pay corresponding higher registration weight to correspond to the impact of those vehicles on the highway. As it now stands, and what we're talking about here is that class of vehicles that has T-plates, and these are the vehicles between 10,000 and 26,000 pounds. So unlike a passenger car, which now goes up to 10,000 pounds and pays $54 every 2 years, these vehicles have a different way of setting fees, and those are on the basis of a declared registration weight. And they pay a correspondingly higher amount, a higher fee, and that's done on an annual basis. The statute talks about combined weight, which in the definition of combined weight is a combination of two or more vehicles coupled together plus their load. Back in the 90s, inadvertently, the term loaded weight was removed from this statute. And what that did was allow the definition, to the statute to be complete in addressing both single and combined vehicles. As it now stands, this statute would not cover, technically, would not cover these large, heavier, single vehicles. So these would be vehicles like perhaps a UPS van, a FedEx truck, a large trade van, a plumber's van that is loaded with maybe a lot of pipe and up around 13,000, 15,000 pounds. Technically, these vehicles, without the definition of loaded weight, these single vehicles, could be registered with a passenger plate. So what we want to do is to put back into that statute the definition of loaded weight so that it does legally capture these heavier vehicles and ensure that they pay their fair share toward the registration weight and to correspond to the impact on the highway. So we think that's a fairly simple fix. It corrects a problem that we picked up on recently that occurred a few years back, and we urge your support. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jack, just for clarification, have there been instances of UPS, FedEx type of trucks trying to register at the passenger car?
Chair Beyer, Representative Buckley, no, I'm not aware of those companies attempting to do that. In fact, you know, we're not sure how many people know about this or would do this. Yeah.
I'm sorry I asked.
Any other questions? I guess I do. You know, when I was first reading about this, I kind of wondered if there, you know, whether there was opposition out there, or I haven't heard from anybody, but has anyone raised any concerns to you about the concept of this bill?
Chair Beyer, no. We haven't heard any concerns about the concept. I think people are interested in seeing if people pay their fair share. We've had discussions with some organizations about different ways of doing this and employing different definitions. But we think this is at this point in time, this is the easiest fix to the statute.
Okay. Thank you. Close the public hearing. Colleagues, before I go into a work session, is there no one's expressed any concerns, or
George is frowning?
I kind of.
All right. Then
can we hold it over?
Yes. Yes.
Good.
Well, this is another one that I wondered about. So we will go ahead on this one and hold it for work session another day, and make sure everybody is comfortable with it. And with that, we are finished for the day, and I am adjourning the committee.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.